Alright, this is Regina Kong with the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. Today is July 11th, 2019, and I'm at Fred's home in Gustavus. I guess, could we begin just by having everyone go around, introduce yourself, say your name, and say a little bit about what you do or where you're from, anything you want.
Okay, I'm Carolyn Elder. I live in Gustavus some of the time. Used to live here permanently, live here part-time now. First came here in 1968 to work at Glacier Bay Lodge, and been around here ever since. That's all.
My name is Fred Howe. I first came here in 1966 and watched the grand opening of the lodge at Glacier Bay, and eventually ended up out at the Hobbit Hole, commercial fishing. And that's what I've done up to about 2 or 3 years ago when we sold the Hobbit Hole and retired. And now I'm in Gustavus, so that's about it.
I'm Lynn Jensen, and I bought my land here in 67, I think. No, I can't remember. In the mid-70s, and built a cabin here, and lived here part-time and then full-time, taught at the school, worked at the park, spent 1 year fishing with Fred out at the Hobbit Hole in 1974, and I know that because I had to look at the slides to verify that, and now I live here part-time here and part-time on Whidbey Island, Washington.
And is there something that you three would like to begin with? I'm curious why you wanted to do a group interview instead of individually. Is there a reason?
Oral support.
Memory right. Support.
Memory support.
Memory support.
Memory
it was a long time
support.
Ago.
Yeah. And as I said, we were having trouble reconstructing what years we were doing different things with the Hobbit Hole, and I have a bunch of slides, so I got my slides out and brought them over when we got together a few days ago, and that helped jog our memories too, but just the three of us like, oh yeah, I remember so and so, and so it helped.
We wanted to make sure we had our stories straight,
yeah.
And we're telling you different things.
Well, I mean, that's pretty normal, I would think. Yeah.
What's an example of something that you all remember differently?
Was there?
Hmm.
I didn't hear the question.
Oh, was there something that you all remember differently?
No. I don't think it was just dates, I think, going back that far.
And then each time one of us would throw out something, it would jog the memory of the others, like, oh yeah, remember so and so, or remember when we did this, or where we went, and so we just built off of each other's memories. And I took a few notes, just names of people and dates. So,
how far back do you three go?
Well, you came in 1966 because your father got a job here as a superintendent.
Right.
And I came up just a couple of years later and worked at the park in that summer, the summer of 1968. And that's when I became acquainted with Bob and especially Doris. I think Doris was kind of the linchpin of this because I knew her at the library at the park. She was a fixture. And so I became first mostly acquainted with Doris and then extended to her family, and then Lynn came not too much after that. So.
Yeah, well, actually, I first met Lynn at the University of Alaska,
yeah,
which
Fairbanks,
was probably
yeah.
67 or 68.
Yeah, right, yeah. And then I was looking to buy land. No, I had been in Minnesota. I'd gone back to Minnesota after I finished school, and then I came back up to go back up to Fairbanks, and I came on the ferry, and I stopped, and you were in Petersburg working at, for the fish.
At the fish weir.
Right, and I stopped, and then you got on the joined me on the ferry and came here, and we flew out here, and I met your mom and your dad, and I looked at this place and saw there was land for sale, and put considered that as a possibility because I wanted to build a cabin. But we first met at the university. We were in the wildlife club together.
Right.
We were in different educational, you know, I was in social work and you were in wildlife management, but we both were in the wildlife club together. So. And then somehow you needed a puller at the Hobbit Hole that summer of 74, and it's a little vague how that all came together, but I came down and fished that summer at the Hobbit Hole, and that was, but I remember another time I was there in the winter.
And that's part I can't remember.
It was pretty soon after you'd purchased the Hobbit Hole, because it was very new, I remember, and still discovering how things worked, and but it was definitely in the winter. There was snow, lots of snow. I don't remember what year that was. So.
Huh.
And Carolyn, you said you were there early on.
Yeah, my first visit was in June 1973, which I verified going back through some old letters that my mother had saved.
Wow.
And that was shortly after you bought the Hobbit Hole. And I remember how excited you all were about that. And so you invited me to go out there on your sailboat. We went out on the sailboat and went to Elfin Cove and then went over to the Hobbit Hole. And I guess we spent a couple nights there or something. I can't remember. So I think I was possibly your first visitor to the Hobbit Hole after you bought it.
Wow.
Do you remember what time you actually purchased? I know you talked about coming out with Jimmy Mahon and who was the other person that you came out with?
Greg,
your brother, yeah. And then you saw the Hobbit Hole, but do you remember what the date was when you purchased it, what time of year it was?
Well, it was in June. And I imagine I could find that date on the paperwork. If it's important, I can look it up.
So you would have been one of the first people mm-hmm. there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So it's possible that it was the next winter that I came down to visit you. I'm not sure. I don't know. It was just early in the time you first were there.
What were, I guess, what was your relationship like with each other back then? So you were friends, so you were all sort of friends?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember when I met Lynn.
Was here, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, when you were building your cabin, I can't remember what year.
And you were building your cabin.
Right, out at Rink Creek.
Yeah, there were a bunch of us hippies building our cabins out here in the 70s.
Yeah.
women.
Well, you build yours all by yourself. I didn't build mine all by myself. Well, at least you started all by yourself.
Yeah, I had help along the way, but mostly I did a lot of it myself. So yeah, we met here. We've been friends ever since. And funny thing is, a lot of people mistake us for each other still to
right.
this day. No. Since I've been back here, it's right. like, oh, Carolyn, no, no, nope.
Do you remember what you thought of each other when you met for the first time, and you?
Oh, I thought Lynn was awesome because she was building a cabin with a milling her logs with a chainsaw, and you milled two sides of the log, or three sides
yeah.
and then the outside stayed round.
Right.
And yeah, that was incredible.
But as far as, I don't know, Fred and I were in wildlife club together, that's all I remember, and the club would go out on adventures, you know, canoeing or whatever, and I don't know. There were quite a few people like Alan and different people in that club that we're still friends with. So mm-hmm. there was a group of people that kind of bonded in, from that club. And
yeah, that got us all the way through school, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you in on the thing where we raised money for the Creamer's Field to purchase the land so that it would become the Crane?
I'm not sure, because I wouldn't be surprised, but I can't definitely remember.
Because the wildlife club, we went and worked for different businesses in town, and the money that we would have earned as employees we donated to the Saving the Crane Habitat Refuge, which was a dairy in Fairbanks that was going to be developed into condos or something, and we wanted to save it for the Sandhill Crane Habitat. So we all, in the Wildlife Club, I remember we all volunteered. I worked for one of the sporting goods stores, and I don't know.
But I don't remember any of that.
Yeah, anyway.
I do remember going to Creamer's Field with a couple of my classmates and crawling around with binoculars in the spring, you know, checking out all the birds that were migrating through and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Remember Tony Smith?
Yeah.
Whatever happened to him?
So did you two run in mutual friend circles?
Yeah.
Well, we were
in
school pretty much, yeah.
I mean, we had other, our circles overlapped, I would say,
yeah,
kind of.
I'm wondering if you could all describe what not only this area in Gustavus, but also just the Hobbit Hole, what it's like in the 70s. If you could describe just like the atmosphere, the community, the people.
Who wants to go first?
Well, everything was a lot smaller people-wise, and especially in Gustavus here. And I think there was only about a dozen cars, because I can remember when we were getting ready to transfer up here, Chuck and Carol Yonda were already here, and Chuck Yonda had worked for my dad, I think, must have been in Blue Ridge Parkway. And so he started sending these charts of Glacier Bay down with all kinds of little notes on them. And then I remember when, because they had a little VW bug, and I remember when Carol had some kind of an accident on the road. And she said, I don't know how it could have happened when there's only another dozen cars in the whole place. And as far as out around the Hobbit Hole was concerned, in those days, there were not very many float planes. because the float planes usually only came once or twice a week for mail, and there were no sport fishing lodges and no charter boats. The only other boats you saw were commercial fishermen. And like I say, Gustavus was really small. And about the only thing going on here was the original homesteaders that were doing whatever they were doing. And I didn't spend much time in Gustavus in those days. It was mostly over at the park. So, but I imagine, and in those days there wasn't pretty much the whole personnel crowd, you know, everybody from the park lived over there. You know, they had trailers for the seasonals and permanent housing for the permanents, and that was about it. And it's expanded greatly since.
Oh man, has it?
Right. The summer I fished with Fred was in 74. There were a lot of hippies that were, we were trollers. And so we met quite a few people, Kathy Funt, Sandy and Charlie, Sandy Bird, Charlie Clements, who would come to the Hobbit Hole. Well, Sandy and Charlie came in to can their fish. They were on a small sailboat. And Kathy Funt came in to use the treadle sewing machine to do something. I can't remember what she was doing, but we met people, and at Elf and Cove, and we'd sell our fish, we'd meet, and we were called the hippie fleet, because we were all hippies then.
Could you describe what a hippie is?
Well, I don't know.
You could describe yourself if you can't think of.
I think it was, I mean, part of the part for me building my cabin here, and we were wanting to go back to the land and be more connected to the land, live off the land, build our own houses.
Drop out of the rat race.
Exactly.
Counterculture, kind of just. And then we usually had long hair and wore, I don't know, non-conventional clothing. And I don't know. I guess that's why we were called the hippie fleet.
I would say that freedom was a big theme.
Yeah.
And that's been my theme most of my life. Mm-hmm. Just to be able to do, you know, to be my own boss. That's the way I express it.
I think, too, why maybe we were called the hippie fleet that year is we were all new to commercial fishing, and then there were the old people like Cecil Funt, and who were some of the older fishermen, traditional fishermen,
Jim Lewis, and you know, people at the Cove, because Elf and Cove, well, even after that time, but before that time, Elf and Cove was strictly a fishing village, and with, you know, support staff, like laundry, and they had a little store. I think they had a little store in those days.
And the restaurant.
And the rest, right, the inn.
Cafe, yeah. So I think because we were all new, young people coming in for the first time, and the older trollers that had been doing this traditionally for however long,
right,
were, I think they couldn't quite
they
figure
quite
out.
Couldn't grasp us.
Yeah.
But they kind of liked us, I think. And they kind of, I mean, we were kind of a conversation piece, let's put it that way. And I don't know what Greg told you, but as I remember, what the fishermen used to call the Hobbit Hole was the pothole comes to mind real easily. And so, of course, the locals turned that into the Habit Hole.
Oh.
Remember?
No. No. I don't remember that.
I don't know.
But I can't, I'm trying to think of the original name. It used to be that the Hobbit Hole was a place where the tenders would come, because that was back before there were any, Excursion Inlet was probably in existence. Mm-hmm. But most of the troll fish were going into, coal storage. And so the coal storage would send out a tender, a big boat, with a big load of ice, and everybody'd rendezvous at the Hobbit Hole and sell their fish and get another load of ice and go fishing again.
Now, so were they in the inside or outside?
I think a lot of it was actually inside.
Wow, because they had to come in on the tides.
Right, but remember that, we've lost at least 2 feet of water due to isostatic rebounds since we got there.
Right.
So, and there's a picture that I just saw in one of these scrapbooks, or maybe you had the picture of the Nova when the Forester was in there.
Yeah, I had a slide of that. Yeah.
And so there must have been a lot more water in those days.
Mm-hmm. So the big boats could have gone in and out.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Regina, if you ever walk around the Hobbit Hole, which you probably have, at low tide, you'll still find old chunks of cable and all kinds of old rusting junk. A lot of it's totally disintegrated now, but it's been a site of activity for a long time. And before we were there, then the Native Americans were there, because it's the ideal place. It's a calm, sheltered place to pull your canoe out of the water, but it's right on the outer coast where all action is.
Do you know how they got the name of the Indian Islands?
That I don't.
It would be interesting to know. Is it shortened Indian Islands, or
I don't know.
I've looked that up in the Dictionary of Alaska Place Names, and I don't know if there's any notation on how it got the name or not. I'm guessing it was just a topographical error.
Yeah, a typo.
Yeah.
Left the D off. Well, and Carolyn is given credit for the name for the Hobbit Hole.
Right, so could we go through, so you said potholes? Could you go through the names that the Hobbit Hole had before the Hobbit Hole? Again?
Well, the pothole was the first one, and then after all the hippies started showing up and started growing pot, then the locals started calling it the Habit Hole. And eventually it turned to the Hobbit Hole.
They should have stuck with pothole.
Because
you were growing pot.
So pothole was because?
I don't know.
No.
Well, it's just sort of a, I would say that's a mariner's name for a little tiny anchorage like that. It's just a pothole. I mean, there used to be one up in Glacier Bay, but I think it's gone totally dry now.
Right.
That I remember Katie, something or other from Sitka, that was Jack Boyd was hanging around with for a while.
Oh, yeah.
She remembers, I remember her telling about going on family trips up Glacier Bay and going into this little place that's up near where you go through the gut behind Russell Island there.
I was going to say, I thought it was by Russell Island.
Yeah.
Some people called it the Teacup.
The Teacup.
Yeah, but it was the same place.
But that's where the basic, the pothole, that's just a pothole. Just like we have on the streets in some places around here.
And so, Carolyn, you're credited with the Hobbit Hole. Tell me more about how that came about.
Well, it must have been in that the only time I had visited or did visit there in those early days was 1973 after they first bought it. Then I didn't go back for quite a few years. Well, we went back in 70 when I fished with
when
you.
Fished,
in
whenever that
77.
Was. We figured that out.
77 or 78, 77. You thought, you know.
But anyway, it must have been in June 73. And I remember I was reading Tolkien at the time. And somehow, I don't know, you said, you remember going for a walk up on that, through the kind of elfin woods.
On the muskeg there.
Yeah, up on the muskeg there. And I get, I don't have a real strong memory of any of this, but I guess I was musing about the little creatures, the elfin creatures that might be inhabiting this place, and I guess I threw out the name Hobbit Hole, and I think you said, "Hey, I like that," if I remember correctly. Blame
right.
it on it. Think it's stuck.
That's the closest to actual nailing it down that I've heard so far.
Yeah, so that's whether that's a valid memory. It is. It's a memory, but.
Well, it means it makes sense because a lot of people were reading Tolkien in those
days.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Is that when the books came out?
No.
I think they've been out for a while.
Been out for longer.
But they were sort of standard hippie reading, I guess you could say.
Yeah, yeah, more hippiedom.
And what year did you say that was?
73.
73. Oh, okay, so about the year that you bought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've also heard something about Hobbit hats.
Oh, what? I should have brought my hat.
Darn. I've got one around here somewhere, too. But, yeah, my mom started knitting these. They were, I think they were modeled after Maltese fisherman's hat. Out of nice, natural, dark brown wool. They were real itchy. And they had little ear flaps and, you know, with the buttons so you could button them. And they were really nice, you know, for cold weather or when it was pouring rain. And then my mama added a little three-way tassel sort of thing on the top, and that made it an official Hobbit hat.
If you had the tassel, you had been to the Hobbit Hole and spent time there, but she made them for, like, she'd auction them off at the 4th of July, but they didn't have
the little tassel.
The tassel. So those were not official Hobbit people. They were Hobbit hats, but not Hobbit people hats. So.
And this was after the Hobbit Hole was called the Hobbit Hole?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Doris would knit these hats, and for anyone who spent time at the Hobbit Hole got an official Hobbit hat with the tassel, but she'd knit the other ones for other people.
And so I remember hats.
I have one at my house.
These had a chin strap.
Yeah.
Right.
Because I remember some that she knitted that were just...
Oh, just the regular
watch cap type.
Yeah, yeah, she
did that too. Those were not really
Hobbit hats.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I ever had a real Hobbit hat when I had one of those.
Now, mine is blue.
Blue?
Blue,
wow.
But it has the tassel, and she knew, I guess, that that was my favorite color, so she knit me a blue one. But it is itchy, so I don't wear it very often, but yeah. I have it right here in Gustavus, so.
Have you interviewed Tyga and Ryland yet?
Tyga, yes. Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times Ryland will show up with his Hobbit hat, or Tyga will show up with his Hobbit hat on.
Oh.
So, but I just was looking at one of these scrapbooks, and this is a funny little story. There's a picture of Ronald Greer. You remember Ron? Did you ever, maybe,
I
you remember
know
Ron?
Him, yes. Uh-huh.
Actually, he went to school with us up there, but I don't remember him up there. But anyhow, he's holding some stalks of marijuana up. And so then I remember the first time that my mom came out to visit, and we had some pot planted at the end of the garden. And I was showing her the garden, and of course I wasn't mentioning there was any pot, because we assumed that our parents didn't know anything about anything like that. But as we were going along, my mom said, "Oh, and there's your pot plants."
Oh my, how did she know?
And that's exactly what I said. And she said, "Oh, we've got some growing at the Institute of Northern Forestry."
Really?
Where she was the librarian in Juneau. And there's a guy that's still around who had a permit to grow them legally.
Why? How did he get that, I wonder?
It has something to do with the Institute of Northern Forestry. But this particular guy, and I wish I could think of his name, but I can't. It's probably just as well. was also the kind of a person that probably smoked pot. So that's why he got the permit to do it. But I just got such a kick out of it when my mom said, "Oh, and there's your pot plants."
Jeez. Oh, that's hilarious.
Didn't faze her a bit.
Yay. Another memory we were talking about was the cake.
Right.
So Doris would make this chocolate cake with chocolate mint frosting, and she'd send it out to the Hobbit Hole for the boys.
Anytime somebody came in or something, right, they always came back with a cake.
And so, and then she would also contribute it to the 4th of July auction here. And so when she passed away, because I had the recipe for that cake, the obligation for making that cake for the 4th of July auction fell onto my shoulders. And as long as I'm here, I make it. And if I'm gone, I ask Carolyn to make it. So
it brings in a lot of money.
It was, this year, it sold for $125, but it's gone for over $200. In the older days, people who remember Doris would bid high on that cake in her memory, and now fewer and fewer people remember who Doris is, but there's a few.
Yeah.
So this year, Anya Myers bought it for $125.
Well,
yeah, so anyway, the original recipe, it's called All Fool's Cake, and I just now call it the 4th of July cake because that's kind of its tradition now. But I remember hauling that cake out to the Hobbit Hole a few times.
Yeah.
Big sheet pan. It is good cake. It's really good cake.
It is.
What makes it good?
Chocolate, and it's got chocolate mint frosting. And it's just really good.
And it's a real thick, heavy cake.
Yeah.
And the other thing that used to come when the cake came often would be a bottle of rhubarb sauce, because I really liked rhubarb sauce.
Oh.
So that was the other big treat.
Do you have rhubarb plant out there? Did you plant rhubarb out there?
We had plants out there, but they kind of got root bound, and then Molly replanted some on the, let's see, because you've just been out there recently. And if you're walking up the boardwalk and around the front of the house and up towards my house, mm-hmm. there's a kind of a garden on the left mm-hmm. that used to be a big strawberry patch. And then at the far end of it, there's a great big blueberry bush. Well, on the near end of it is where Molly planted a bunch of rhubarb. And I don't remember.
It all died. I worked with Molly on that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't make it.
There's different rhubarb now.
Yeah, now they've got some.
I guess not the original.
Because it used to be out where the two-story outhouse, as I call it, is.
Yeah.
There used to be rhubarb right in there, just to the right of the trail.
Because a lot of the old-timers always had a rhubarb patch, and even up at Reed Inlet, Ibex had rhubarb plant mm-hmm. up there,
mm-hmm.
and I think they brought it over from Lemashire or something. But so I'm just assumed there would be rhubarb at the Hobbit Hole when you first bought it, because that old couple, I assumed they would have had it there.
And there was, and that was a really good strawberry garden for a long time, and Deborah used to weed it and keep it in good shape, but eventually it kind of went by the wayside. It might have just been burned out.
So, Carolyn, earlier you described Doris as a fixture of the community. I've heard a lot about Bob, but not so much about Doris.
Yeah, Doris.
I'm wondering what your memories of her are.
Oh, Doris was wonderful. Yeah, she was just a very sweet lady who doted on her family, and she volunteered at the library, and she was always just so good-hearted to everybody in the community, and she was,
she helped start the public library here.
That's right.
So when, because she did the park library long ago. Have you been in the park library? Because there's that picture there of her is also at the park library. And she started that library, that research library out there. But when we used to hear, we used to get our library books by mail from the state library, and they would send us each a box of books, and then we'd read them and send them back. And eventually the state library said, you people out there are reading, we're just, you know, you have, there's so many, we were all readers, and they said, you need to have your own library. And so Doris helped, because she was the only real librarian. None of us really knew anything about how to do a library. So she trained many of us, me, Sally Lesh, Mary Hervin, Carol Baker, I'm not going to remember everybody. And we started the library. It was where City Hall is right now. And then eventually it got that place was too small. Mary Hervin donated the building that she bought from the church camp, and for a dollar, I think, or something, she donated it or to the community, and we started the library there. And then eventually we raised the money to build the library that's down here. But she totally was, it wouldn't have happened without Doris, because we had no idea how to catalog or do anything, and she was the person. And I just remember her as very soft-spoken, very sweet. I felt very close to her. I was here when she died. She died in this house here, and there were several of us, Kate and me, and that were, you know, with her around the clock while she was dying. And it was a big loss. She was a very quiet, but a very strong presence in the community, and just big heart, you know. She'd do anything for you. And I learned a lot from her just on how to, you know, cook and can and preserve and just everything. I mean, she knew a lot of things about how to live, and she was a mentor to many of us women in this community when we, don't you think, too?
Yeah.
So, yeah. There's a picture of her at the public library, too.
Oh.
And a picture at the park library, so. She was our library mother and mother. I used to call her my Alaska mom. Because, you know, my mom's in the Midwest. And I saw her like once a year, and Doris was like, Doris, how do you do this? Or whatever, you know. She was just an amazing woman. Did you know that, Fred?
Yeah, I did, because Mom was she graduated from the University of Minnesota Library School in Rochester.
Oh, wow.
And I remember saying, maybe not often, but occasionally, that's all I ever wanted to be, is a librarian. And then I met Bob Howe. And my tongue's been hanging out ever since, trying to keep up with him.
Yeah? Where did they meet?
They met at, I think it was a summer botany, you know, a summer course in botany, and I can't think of the name of it. It's a part of the University of Minnesota, and it's a place that a lot of people recognize the name of, but anyhow, that's apparently where they met. So
they were both living in Minnesota at the time, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know Doris talked a lot about all the different parks that she lived in, yeah. You know, went with your dad, and I remember, I think, were you born in North Carolina or somewhere?
Greg was.
Where were you born?
Mississippi.
Oh, that was it.
That was the first Park Service post that my dad had.
Okay.
And Natchez Trace.
Ah, right, because I remember her describing giving birth, and she somehow got, I don't know if whatever, she was thinking, she was rowing a boat, she said, she's like, pull, you know, pull, and she was, you know, the contractions were pull, you know, it was more like push, I guess, but she said she felt like she was rowing this boat, and I thought, whoa, I don't know if it was you or Greg, but I think it was you. It must have been a difficult birth because you both have big heads.
Oh, God.
I think that was one of the reasons I decided not to have children was because of that description.
Oh, man.
Anyway.
Well, that's, I really... I appreciate that testimony from both of you about my mom, because my dad was, I used to think when I was thinking about coming to Gustavus, I was thinking, gosh, I'm going to be in, I feel like I'm always in Bob Howe's shadow. I was telling that to my friend Ellen, and then we reviewed it a year or two ago, and I said, there's hardly anybody in Gustavus anymore that remembers who he was, except the old timers.
Yeah.
So.
But they remember Doris.
They remember Doris, yeah.
I mean, fewer and fewer, but she really had more of a lasting impact here in Gustavus than your dad, for sure. There is a legacy, though, is Howe Hour.
Yeah.
Which is, Bob would always have happy hour at, was it every night?
It was every night, yeah.
I thought so. At 5 o'clock, come over and you'd have, what was his favorite drink? Bourbon?
He liked bourbon.
And popcorn. There'd be popcorn and drinks and every night. And then when he passed away, Mary Hervin, I think, inherited the tradition, or she took it on, and she called it Howe Hour.
Hmm.
But it was only Friday nights, not every night. At 5 o'clock, go over drinks and snacks, and then Carolyn took it over when Mary passed or moved, and then mm-hmm. Now it's come full circle back to Greg.
Yeah.
Actually, there's one this week at Mary's Friday night because her granddaughter,
Mary Hervin's house, yeah,
granddaughter's here, Bobby. Yeah. So she's hosting.
Yeah, and she hosted it last week.
Right,
too,
I couldn't go last week, but yeah. So anyway, another legacy is Howe Hour, Happy Hour, Howe Hour. The cake and Howe Hour and the libraries.
I'm trying to figure out how, you know, I know that he had it right here.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know who all came. I know Jack Lesh used to come pretty regularly.
Bill came.
I think probably Greg.
I remember seeing Bill Kruger here. And I came not very often, but once in a while.
Yeah, same here.
I don't think there were people here every night, but he always said, come by any night at 5.
Happy hours at 5.
Huh. Well, I guess the reason a lot of this stuff is kind of new to me is because once I started fishing out at the Hubbard Hole, I kind of let my life be taken over by fishing because I really liked it, and I guess that's all I can say, but I feel like I kind of missed out on a lot of stuff. I didn't come over here very often anymore, and Greg, you know, he used to come back over here more often, and he spent more time when I was going to school and working for Fish and Game and various other, or commercial fishing during the summer, he was usually here, so he sort of has more roots here than I do.
We're glad you're back.
Yeah, well, it's nice to be back.
So where did you get your provisions mostly? Did you just do a huge shop in Juneau and then?
Oh, you mean when we were fishing? Okay, yeah. So now we're going to get to a Hobbit Hole story,
okay.
Right?
Great.
Okay, well, after Greg and I got, first I started fishing first, and then Greg was buying fish, and he saw that I was having a lot of fun and making a little bit of money, so then he decided to go fishing, and then, like, we had all our hippie friends around, so pretty quick, we had a hippie fleet. And so it was pretty disorganized at first. You know, it was like, who's going to cook what and, you know, whatever. But eventually we got to the point where we actually hired a cook, gardener, for the summer. And in the winter, because I decided fairly soon that I didn't really want to spend the whole winter out there. So I started going down south, and I'm not really sure when that was. That was probably in the late 70s. But anyhow, so I'd buy a huge pile of groceries down at Costco in Silverdale, long before there was a Costco in Juneau. And just about every winter, somebody, Dennis Montgomery or somebody, would be down there with a boat. And so we'd take all the groceries. This is after I had my house down there. Take all the groceries to my house, rebox them, and then go load them down on whoever's boat was coming up north. And
was that Port Townsend that you mm-hmm. loaded them onto the boat?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And then we'd find a cook or, you know, somebody that would, and we paid them. And everybody, I forget how, I guess it was Greg and I mostly that financed the groceries. And then at the end of the summer, Greg would divvy up the salary for the cook, gardener, and all the groceries. And everybody'd get a little bill. And that's how it worked. And you know, it evolved into, to, you know, we had like 6 or 8 boats there at one time fishing. And that's when we started, well, we finally got a shower up on the hill at the hot tub. There's still a hot tub up there. You've probably seen it. The one up there, the one up on the hill, or the one down on the beach?
Now it's down on the beach. I don't know if it's the same one or not.
Yeah, there's an old tin one up on the hill that used to be just perfect for 2 people. And so you go up and take your shower, and then if the hot tub was hot, you'd sit in the hot tub for a while. And it got everybody together. So we'd all talk about where we'd been fishing and how many fish we caught, and then have dinner, and then that at that time, the big house, I think you might have seen the pictures of the rebuild in that one scrapbook, but it was, at first it was just that one little room where the step comes off and the big beams are. So there were like 15 or 16 of us sitting there in this one little spot and having dinner. And then somebody'd do the dishes and everybody go back out and go to sleep on their boats because it was going to be early get up the next day, as it always was. So those were the good old days. And looking through these scrapbooks, I've seen all these people that I recognize and I don't even remember who they are, really. Because we had people just show up and hang out for a week or two and work in the garden or whatever, and then they'd move on. So.
What were some of your favorite things to do at the Hobbit Hole? Anyone?
I was only there the one summer, mm-hmm. but I loved hiking and just going out like that one evening in the laundry. Is that what it's called, the laundry mm-hmm. chute? And there were porpoises.
Oh, right.
And the sun was setting, and it was like, man, this is just magical. And just the whole place, fishing out there, so gorgeous. I mean, just incredibly gorgeous. And mm-hmm. just being out in that beautiful country, and fishing wasn't always so much fun, but it was okay, but it depended on the weather, and, you know, if it was pouring rain and you're, you know, and then you'd, like, tie yourself to the trolling pole and you're gutting fish, and that wasn't so much fun, but it was a wonderful time, and all the hippie fleet, and just selling the fish in Elfin Cove, and I don't know.
Oh, and we had used to have our 4th of July's. Because in the old days, the fishing season opened a lot earlier. Now the main season opens the 1st of July, so it's like kind of get cheated out of our 4th of July. In those days, we had a huge get-together on the 4th of July. And I remember one year when the 4th of July was coming up, there used to be a lot of crabs in the Hobbit Hole, Dungeness. So I set out 4 pots, and then somebody showed up with 40 game hens or something like that. So we didn't even pull the crab pots.
Oh.
We just cooked up the game hens. And the next day I went out and pulled the crab pots, and they were all just stuffed. I mean, like 40 crabs in each one of them. And so that's... Now there's none as far... I mean, sometimes you see the little immature ones in there before they get big enough for the sea otters to munch them down, you know?
You think it's the sea otters?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Because... I remember once one of the local crab fishermen, Bob Slider, I don't know if he's still fishing, but he's still around, came cruising in, and we all waved, and he waved, and he set 3 or 4 pots out, and then he went back out, and we waved, and he waved, and then I went out and pulled his pots and took the bait out of them all.
You did?
Yeah.
He was in the Hobbit Hole.
Oh, he came in and set his pots, and then he left.
Oh my gosh!
And so we kind of took that as a, not really an insult, but it's just like we kind of thought of it as our territory.
Yeah.
And so that's why I went out and took all the bait out of the pots, and he came back a few days later and pulled all his pots, and they were all empty, and he waved, and we waved, and we never saw him again.
He got the message.
He got the message. Oh, God.
I know, I heard stories about here in Bartlett Cove area. Who was Duke.
Duke.
Was the crab fisherman, and he would put pots out. But sometimes if people wanted crab, they would pull up his pots, they would take what they wanted, and they'd put a bottle of booze in as payment.
Right.
And let it back down again. I remember
a lot of times that's what people would do. They'd pull a pot and take a couple crabs and stick in a six-pack or a bottle or something. And
yeah, as payment, yeah.
That was sort of accepted, but nowadays it's...
There's no crab,
there's no
right?
Crab.
Very little.
Speak of around here.
Yeah.
And those were the days, in one of the scrapbooks I was just looking at, when we used to trawl for shrimp. We had a little miniature trawl that you can get from Memphis Net and Twine, and we'd go up an Idaho Inlet and drag it around behind a boat and pull it up, and we'd just have it packed full of shrimp and tanner crabs and things like that. And Dennis still does that. Oh, he doesn't trawl for him. He's developed, you know, Dennis being an engineer type. You know Dennis Montgomery?
No, not really.
You know who I'm talking about,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Dennis has built these, because the fishing game has, you know, you can only have a certain amount of volume. So Dennis has designed something that's real efficient. And it stacks, you know, so you can stack pots together. And he still does, on most years, does fairly well with shrimp.
Where does he fish for
just
them?
Just in Idaho Inlet.
Oh, okay.
Right in Idaho Inlet, yeah.
So one summer I fished with Ed Wyman, and he fished in Glacier Bay. And we fished for shrimp and for crab. And we went into Charpentier, and what's the other name of that?
Skidmore.
Yeah, that area. And we set shrimp. They were like cages. They were square with netting. And we got some shrimp, but not much. He was thinking he'd sell to the lodge and make a killing, but we barely got enough for dinner most of the time. But we also, in the Beardsleys, we'd fish for crab and different places. But he had come up with this pattern for this and made these shrimp cages. And anyway, we got a few.
And what about you, Carolyn? A few times you were there, what did you enjoy doing? What did you enjoy about the Hobbit Hole?
I really had not spent that much time at Hobbit Hole until my son got so involved in it. In recent years, I've been out there a lot, but in all those many years from 1973 until just recently, I was probably there three or four times. So I really don't have a lot of history there. But let's see. We spent my 50th birthday out there, which was in 99. I guess that was in 99. I was born in 49, so yeah. That was a great time. And yeah, I just love I love that walk over to Magic Beach and Eagle Beach, and kayaking, and just watching the amazing wildlife show that's always going on around there, and hiking up to the top there, and it's beautiful. It's just a Everyone uses the word magical, but it is. It's a magical place.
Yeah, I agree. There's something special about that whole area. And
something happens when you're there with a group of people and you just bond or something. There's just so much sharing that place as people become really, everybody's doing something and just conversation is really easy because, you know, you're just out there with no distractions of modern technology or anything, pretty much, and just there with your group and nature. Yeah, it's wonderful. Kind of a retreat, I guess you'd say. It's a retreat from the civilized world. Yeah, it's a very special place.
Go ahead.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
I might have missed it while I was gone there. When did Zach first go to the Hobbit Hole, and when did he first?
We went there just when he was young, when he was a kid. We just went there, I don't know, a few times. I think he was there for my 50th birthday. I remember we went there once when he was, I don't know, 10-ish or something, and we had a picnic over on Magic Beach, and he and Danny got lost in the woods there somehow. They were lost for, I don't know, seemed like a couple hours or something. Nobody could find them. They were just, I don't know how they got lost. But anyway, they finally found their way to the beach. So he went out there. He might have gone out there with some other friends as well than when I wasn't there. I can't remember, but whatever it was, it sure made an impression on him, because he just...
Yeah, well, that's that's what's amazing to me about it, is that he apparently has held, you know, had these feelings for a long time, you know?
Yeah. He'll have to tell you about that. I can't really...
Yeah. Because I just... All I remember is that the realtor that Greg hired, this is a story I've heard anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
Greg probably brought him back here to Gustavus in the skiff, and he was wandering around waiting for the airplane, and he ran into Zach, and that's when the whole thing started.
Yeah, I think the realtor said something like, gee, it would be great if somebody would buy that and turn it into eco-retreat or something like that, and...
Oh, wow.
And Zach, a light bulb just went off in Zach's mind, and from then on he was obsessed.
I know.
And that was what was going to happen, and he was going to make it happen.
But how old was he then? I mean, was he at Stanford at that time, or?
When did you put it on the market, do you remember?
I don't really remember. But... That's something we can always find out.
Yeah.
Because, and a lot of the reason, it's because Greg and I were both getting old.
Right.
And Greg especially, because he's the one that spent the winters there all the time. And he never complained about it up until the very end, and then he started...
Yeah.
...getting upset because I didn't spend more time there, and... And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that Elfin Cove was sort of disappearing. And that's when Greg and Jane started coming over here more often to Halloween and things like that, and Christmas. And because the Elfin Cove was, well, it was, a, you know, at one time a fairly lively little place. And it just started evaporating in the wintertime.
They used to have a school, you know, it was part of the school district. They had kids that...
had kids there and everything.
That's wintered there, obviously, because of school.
Yeah.
They had a school, so...
So when that started happening, that's when Greg and Jane really wanted to bail out. And I just, as I've said to several people, if they hadn't wanted to leave, or if they'd have just left and not wanted to sell it, I'd probably still be out there until it fell down around my ears. But I'm glad what happened happened.
It's a wonderful legacy.
The best possible way of taking care of it.
Wonderful.
Because we didn't want it to become another lodge.
Oh, that would have been a travesty.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the future of the Hobbit Hole now? With this, with Zach's school there and student groups coming in.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
It's the best thing that could happen. Really, I think.
Yeah, I agree. It's perfect. And it sounds like everything's working out pretty well.
And all that magic will be preserved and not tainted by some lodge, like you say, that just commercializes it. And
yeah.
I mean, it will be preserved. The magic will continue. And
it'll be dispersed with every student.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just amazed at the energy out there when I went out just to the work party. Just for that one day, and everybody was working their butts off, pitching in, gardening, and chopping firewood or splitting firewood, and everything was going on. And boy, the youthful energy was just amazing to see. It's like, okay, it's all yours now, you guys. Go for it. Make it yours. Make it happen. You've got the energy to do it, and it's awesome.
Yeah. We don't have the energy anymore.
Exactly.
We're too old.
Yeah, I really am amazed by how much energy I don't have anymore. Good.
Things take a little longer.
Everything
to do
takes forever. It's like time's going so fast. But it's really just going the same as always. Just it takes me so much longer to do anything.
Yeah.
Before we end, is there anything else that you'd like to mention that you didn't get to talk about?
I'm glad we're still all here and still friends.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad Fred's back here in Gustavus, because I hardly ever saw you after that summer fishing, because you were...
I was fishing.
You were fishing and I was here or somewhere, and Carolyn and I are still friends. In fact, she spends the winter in Squim, and I spend the winter on Whidbey Island, so we're not that far away from each other. We get to do stuff together down there even. And Fred's in Port Townsend, but I never see him. And we have to fix that.
Yeah, actually, I guess there's an Alaska group in Port Townsend that I haven't gotten in touch with them yet. But yeah, I don't know if Greg ever told you about one of my favorite parts is how we first ended up out there, and which is when Greg and I and Jimmy Mahan hopped in that little sailboat that's down here on the beach right now that Eric has now. And we left Gustavus here. It was a beautiful day, and we were going to go circumnavigate Jacobi Island. But we knew about the Hobbit Hole. My mom had found it in a real estate ad in Juneau newspaper. And I had seen the location of it when I went out on the Park Service on the Nunatak. The Nunatak went out to Elfin Cove once. The Nunatak used to be the kind of the supply boat for Bartlett Cove and the Park Service before they got rid of the Nunatak, and I guess everything comes in by airplane or some other freight handling service nowadays. But in those days, we went out and they had a PR, you know, a little PR thing for the people of Elfin Cove. And when we went by South Pass, you could see the pilings in there that are outside now, where you probably land on the big boat anytime you go out in a big boat. So we sort of knew where it was, and we thought, well, we should go check it out. So we did. And we sailed right in and tied up to the dock and went up to the house, and everything was just like the Freeds had packed up and gone to town for the weekend and never came back. There were curtains and dishes in the cupboards, and actually it wasn't the Freeds, because there were some other people that had it for a couple of years, but so the three of us were just sort of hanging out and wandering around, and we just sort of decided that we got to have this place. And so as the story goes, and Greg may have had a different version, but we came back to Gustavus, and the folks were kind of wondering what happened, why we got back so soon. And so we told them, we took down all the for sale signs first. And a friend of Greg's father knew the owner, the present owner, and who was working for AELP, and he was out on a field station. So they called him in, and he and Greg got together at the Red Dog Saloon, as the story goes, and wrote out a bill of sale on the back of a napkin, and that's what got it all started.
That's great.
Well, I guess that's it. Thank you all so much.
All right.
Great. You made it.